I'm going to ask our marshal to recall this case for presentation.
Calling case number 8221177, State versus Berry.
And Mr. DeMarco, when you're ready, the podium also has a button if you need to move it up or down for your best way for you to reach it.
May it please the court, counsel. We're here today on...
And for introduction, you are Alexander DeMarco?
Your Honor, Alexander DeMarco, D-E space, M-A-R-C-O, appearing on behalf of the defendant, Dominic Berry.
Thank you.
Your Honor, we are here today to address a number of issues expounded upon in brief, but fundamental among them this is a case where the defendant petitioned the court to proceed pro se. He petitioned the court on, I believe, October 5th, 2020, less than 2 months after his first appearance. Your Honor, that I think is significant to start there. It is kind of the fundamental thrust of my appeal. On October 5th, when that waiver is put in, what is strange is that it's clear Mr. Berry isn't satisfied with his public defender. Not uncommon for public defenders to be discharged and a private attorney to take over. It's not uncommon for a public defender to be discharged temporarily while the defendant seeks counsel. As noted in my brief, the court says that the first question I'm going to ask you is whether or not you intend to hire your own attorney or represent yourself. And the defendant doesn't manifest at first an intention to represent himself completely. It's either or. He says it's either or depending on the finances right now, but it's a problem of cost. And the court says, I'm sorry. And he says, yeah, it's probably that's something I'm pursuing as well. But what's interesting is that apparently, because he doesn't want the public defender to represent him during this hearing, they don't choose the move to hearing, the comeback at another time with counsel. He has apparently manifested an intention to discharge the public defender, but then we're presented with a petition to proceed pro se. There is a form online. Obviously, the form is presented to the court.
He didn't just present a petition to the court. I mean, the record shows that he met with the supervisor of his public defender, and the supervisor, according to the on the record waiver of counsel, carefully went over the petition with appellant before the district court judge discharged the public defender.
Well, and by carefully, we mean going line through line with this form that's online. There isn't, to the extent we're stipulating anything, I am not denying that line by line it was gone through with Mr. Berry and that it was gone through on the record in a rather routine fashion.
And what is legally deficient about that?
Your Honor, And as I argue in my brief, Your Honor, I feel that we've standardized it to the point that it's that when somebody makes that petition, the law as it stands now is there almost isn't anything that can happen that will cause the court to disapprove of that petition. When somebody enters a petition to enter a guilty plea, the court can listen to his statements of that, and the court can choose not to accept the guilty plea.
Well, I mean, a district court in its discretion can make a determination that the waiver of counsel isn't knowing or intelligent or that or can reject it for some reason or defer a ruling on it for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm struggling to pinpoint what the defect is here that would warrant reversal.
I guess, Your Honor, what I guess I'll boldly say, I believe that the process that is currently in place and the form that we currently use are itself not sufficient to waive counsel under the very strong admonitions of the Zerps case, which I present.
What exactly about the form or the process that we are following that I think we've had a series of recent cases that have affirmed that process and the form, and we have a rule that deals with the form also, or the form is part of the, is attached to the rules. What about it is defective?
Your Honor. I'm looking for this part of my brief here. Your Honor, I think what I'm saying fundamentally is that the form that's used essentially focuses mainly on, and the examination that's done of the defendant is, it focuses on mainly the consequences, punishment, what is being looked at. But that punishment exists whether or not he has a lawyer. Justice, as I say, as Zerps tells us and other cases tell us, it's a process, it's not a result. Merely informing him of what could happen to him, merely informing him that, as the judge said, people go to school for years for this, and that form itself doesn't talk about in detail the advantages and disadvantages, the potential pitfalls in evidence, which is primarily what a lawyer is there for, is to present evidence, is to try to admit evidence or try to keep out evidence. Nothing is described to him about, you know, Mr. Berry, this process is going to involve rules of evidence. It's going to involve you having to admit this evidence, to argue for the admission or to argue to keep out evidence. And those involve some rules that you're probably not very educated on. And that is why you have a right to counsel. That is why we have lawyers in criminal proceedings.
Isn't your argument in tension with another constitutional right, and that is the right of an individual to self-represent in legal proceedings if they choose to do so?
It is certainly a right for a defendant to represent themselves. But as I note in my brief, that is also the court's job to safeguard justice, to safeguard the process, to ensure a fair trial. And I believe, I guess I'll move, because I know our time's limited here, and when, I guess that's kind of where I move on to what I'm fundamentally, if the court is saying that the waiver was good, if the court is saying that the court, that, you know, that he knowingly and intelligently waived this, that right to represent oneself also doesn't matter if somebody doesn't have, isn't even guided toward any of the resources. If I'm a new lawyer and I'm representing criminal defendants in court, and I have questions about e-file, I have questions about where do I go to find this, where do I go to find that, what are some, you know, places in the courthouse that I can research that and that. There's not a judge in the world that will say, well, I'm not allowed to, you know, guide you on that, Mr. DeMarco. I can't tell you anything about what to do, because the court isn't allowed to interfere with the strategy of defense, can't tell them that, and that's fine. That is up to Mr. Berry if he's representing himself. But throughout this, communicating what he wants to the court through the proper channels and at the proper time, getting the discovery, making those demands, having some sort of basic resource like we have for other self-represented people. We have self-help stations at courts that people that want to get divorced quickly without lawyers. We have resources at courts for tenants that are being evicted.
Is there a record? Is there in the record anything that you have raised that he was not provided with. You're talking about access to law libraries and many things like that. I mean, these are concepts that are out there, but I don't know that you have flagged anything specifically that was not afforded to him.
Well, I mean, the status quo is kind of the inside joke that a self-represented defendant doesn't know actually how to do any of these things, but the ongoing fiction is that he does. And the ongoing, you know, fiction is that, well, he has access to all those resources so long as they're sitting there in perpetuity, then the process is fair. The process is being protected. I believe this, and this is new. I don't have case precedent for this. This is what I'm asking. If I'm asking something new of the court today, it is this. Somebody who has petitioned the court to proceed pro se and is having problems with submissions and that kind of thing, maybe even just heading that off at the pass, having this person, you know, have just a sheet of paper that says, here's some good places to do legal research.
Well, I read the transcripts here, and Judge Quam spent a lot of time, along with the prosecutor in the case, answering questions, providing guidance. I mean, the prosecutor offered her phone number to Mr. Berry. You know, should he need assistance? I'm not really sure what other resources Mr. Berry didn't have here.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with Your Honor. I don't believe that Judge Quam really does guide him in that fashion. He keeps being told that, well, you have to go about it the right way. And the judge doesn't have to, like, enunciate, hey, this is what you have to do. The least they could do is say, look, you see that criminal handbook there? In that criminal handbook is a list of the rules of criminal procedures. It has a bunch of cases there that talk about, you know, the proper ways and improper ways that those procedures are fulfilled. But this is the only way to get things efficiently before the court. We have to follow these rules. Mr. Berry, I'm going to ask you to take that home, or I'm going to ask you to, here's where you can access to criminal rules of criminal procedure online. We have to take into account, I believe we have to take into account the relative education, literacy.
But what couldn't he do with, you know, this so-called lack of knowledge? I mean, he litigated his own motion to suppress, and he, you know, may not have complied with every rule to a T, but it looked like a pretty typical suppression hearing, and the issues that he raised were sufficiently pursued and decided.
I would agree with the court that his imperfect motion practice on that particular issue is at least partially honored. Although I do note in the brief that it seems to me he was trying to challenge also the probable cause for the theft, and that is never addressed. The state doesn't question about the theft at all, hardly at all during the hearing. It's focused on the stop, even though in his very chaotic email, an email that the court doesn't read till 4 months after he sends it, that's a problem.
Let me ask you a question that just occurred to me as I'm sitting here. So if we agreed with you and we sent it back, are we then prohibiting your client from, again, if he asked to represent himself? Is he going to have a lawyer, or do we let him go ahead and do the same thing? We could come back and come back and come back.
Well, and this is a part where, as I noted in my brief, I am surmising that, you know, when we talk about a competency, Rule 20 and that kind of thing, we speak fundamentally about a defendant's ability to participate in his defense with the assistance of a lawyer. What I'm asking this court for is that there should be something more than just a form that says, did you read this? Do you understand it? Sign here. It's some sort of inquiry into...
That sounds like you're asking the judicial branch to create a new wheel for, like, a primer for people that choose to be pro se represent themselves.
Yes, and I don't know. I'm not an appellate judge. I wouldn't say that I'm putting forth a multi
editorial that can be watched before they elect to represent themselves. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I'm not. Yes, I'm not. I'm not laying out a four-factor test of what needs to be done to evaluate this person's motives. But I believe that those should be considered. Why are you representing yourself? Why do you think this is a better decision than doing that? And having some sort of penetrating examination on it, and then establishing upon this penetrating examination, we want to know more than just what's on this form. We want to you to understand that there is a process here, but I think that there should be some test that's different than a Rule 20, different than a McNaughton standard. In fact, I would say it's even needs to be even more scrupulous than this when somebody's proceeding without a lawyer, because they are the defense. They're not just
to point out your time has expired, but you do have rebuttal.
Okay, all right. Thank you for the questions. I appreciate the consideration. I really appreciate the court's patience. I'm sorry for my late arrival today.
Understood. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I'd just like to make a few brief points right out of the gate, and then I'm happy to entertain any questions that this panel still has about this appeal. First, I agree with Judge Gaetis' characterization of the record in this case, in that Judge Quam went to fairly lengthy efforts to safeguard appellant's rights and provide appropriate but helpful guidance. And what I'm talking about is that Judge Quam explained that how appellant could put in evidence through his own testimony and the testimony of others, and that's in pages 14 to 15 of the trial transcript. He explained the state's proposed stipulation about appellant's prohibited status and why why that would not be a good idea for appellant to agree to it. That's pages 16 to 18 of the trial transcript. He explained how jury selection would be conducted, pages 19 to 20, and the purpose of opening statements, pages 101 to 102. He explained to appellant when and how he could make a motion for a directed verdict at the end of the state's case, claiming that there would not be sufficient evidence for the case to go to the jury, and then prompted appellant to make that motion at the correct time if appellant wished. That's pages 188 and then 383. During the pretrial stage of this case, back before the trial began, the trial prosecutor, Ms. Krotsky, actually assisted and provided exhibits to the court on behalf of appellant, on behalf and support of his argument. That's pages 8 to 9 of the evidentiary hearing transcript. Both Judge Quam and the trial prosecutor, Ms. Krotsky, treated appellant with respect and help throughout these proceedings. And I go back to something I heard Mr. DeMarco mention about this being tied to the Zerps case. That case was decided by the United States Supreme Court 86 years ago. Our Supreme Court, the Minnesota Supreme Court, has repeatedly addressed this very issue in the past 86 years. It's done so in Rhodes and Seifert and Worthy and Brody. And it has established this process that was correctly followed in here. And the Rule 504 and the specific information that needs to be conveyed to someone who chooses to exercise, as Judge Gaetis pointed out, their constitutional right to represent himself, that was complied with here. I guess the policy argument that I hear coming from Mr. DeMarco is essentially a new rule of procedure beyond what we currently have. And with all due respect to this court, this is an error-correcting court. And the procedure that's been set by the Supreme Court decisions that I mentioned before, as well as by the rules of criminal procedure, was correctly followed in this case. I think that the Minnesota Supreme Court and Seifert said it best, page or pin site 372. The court explained that a criminal defendant who elects to proceed pro se will very likely harm rather than help his chance of success. However, while our state law allows him to do so, he must live with the consequences of so doing. And in this particular case, the rule of law and the procedures that have been established repeatedly again and again were followed. And I understand that it did not work out well for appellant, but that was the choice that he validly made. I have plenty of time left. I'm more than happy to answer any additional questions about this issue or any of the other issues that have been raised in this appeal.
It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Petras. Last word, Mr. DeMarco.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think a significant thing that counsel just stated is that the Zerbst case is 86 years old. There's a lot that's changed in 86 years. It's 2023. One of the things that's changed in those
24. Go ahead, counsel.
Still doing it about end January.
We're correcting court. So.
Yeah, not enough coffee
needed
this
to
morning.
Be said.
I think that it is significant. We've learned a lot more about mental health. We've learned a lot more about education, race, up socioeconomic status, how that all affects a person's understanding into adulthood. And I feel the transcripts in these cases, it's to me, when I read the transcripts of trial, I look at it and say, this guy didn't have a chance. He's invariably allowed to, goes on and on and on, threatening witnesses in court, spouting off all sorts of absolutely insane and outer space conspiracies and accusations and threats. And there is, at that point, the jury is irrevocably prejudiced. And I think just when a person is facing prison on the line, to just let the clown show continue in the courtroom and understand, when everybody knows the outcome. I've been in these proceedings where we have pro se defendants. I've seen attorneys kind of snickering in the hall, and everybody thinks that, oh gosh, here's this guy again, or we got another speeding ticket trial that somebody's trying to make a mountain out of a molehill on. This is a very serious situation, and in other...
Counsel, I understand the characterizations here, but in fairness to the district court judge and the prosecutor in this case, neither of them exhibited any kind of derogatory or disrespectful indicators towards your client.
I'm not alleging that sort of impropriety.
I just want to make that clear.
But I do think... It's so consequential. This isn't a divorce or landlord litigation or anything. He's facing multiple years in prison. And we have all of these resources that we direct litigants to in these other areas. We have these resources in the courthouse. And they do, and those resources for criminal law, they exist. But we're not giving any guidance of people to say, look, if you're going to represent yourself, here's just a few basic procedures.
I think Mr. Petras just stood up and explained all of the pointers that the district court judge gave during the trial itself. I mean, exactly the type of information you're suggesting was not given was provided to Mr. Berry.
I respectfully disagree. I don't believe that he had any knowledge of all about criminal procedure. I don't think he was directed at all. Like, these are what the rules say. Here, read this, go to this, like, have at least, like, even just 5 lines on a piece of paper about the basic websites that people go to, that attorneys consult when proceeding with a trial. I feel like that if we're doing that in other areas of law, we should be doing that. We should at least be giving not just having the resources exist in perpetuity, and saying something more to the defendant than just Judge Quam said about, you know, hey, you're going to go, you know, you're going to be allowed to present evidence, what you're allowed to do, what your, you know, it doesn't tell him exactly, here are the resources for telling you what's relevant, what's not, how to get, how to get discovery. He seems to be mystified again and again about how to get that, and making those demands, and not just regular discovery, but perhaps getting background on what happened in the rest of the investigation. I guess I would point out in this case, it starts with a shot spotter. And I'd ask the court I'm going to get a little bit left, when considering the probable cause for stop and all of that, I would point out that the ShotSpotter rings out six shots. They investigate. As of today, there's no evidence that any kind of shooting took place whatsoever. And when the officers arrived at the house before they pulled him over, they didn't find anything. And so was it ever solved? Was there anything that happened after that revealed some crime occurred? It doesn't appear to. And I think that affects the stop, but I think not having access to the discovery of additional materials or not having the rules that will allow him to get that.
And your time has expired. I need to call that to your attention.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your remarks today. The matter is deemed submitted. The decision will be issued in statute.